Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Mentoring Moments. I am here with one of my new mentees, Katie, from Equipad, and it is awesome to have you on the call today. And you have a D2C brand with Equestrian Products, and you design, you manufacture, you direct sell in Australia, and you also have some retail accounts, like some wholesale accounts that are retailing your products through physical retail stores as well. So you have a small wholesale side of the business, but most of your business, as I understand it, is D2C today, and you're always range extending, looking at ways you can expand. Okay, how can I expand my SKU count? Where does it make sense to do so? Where is some blue ocean opportunity here? But for today, you wanted to talk a little bit more about what does potential wholesale expansion into new markets, new regional markets, what might that look like? Is that, am I understanding your question correctly?
100%. That's exactly my question. I think we've established our roots really strongly here in Australia, and now we're looking at how we can establish those same roots, but in a new market, different country. Understanding things might work differently, but I think there is a good consensus around the sort of B2B relationship, wholesale, retail, and what that sort of looks like.
Fantastic question. And look, I think this is something that almost every D2C brand, if they aren't already looking at it, they should be looking at it, because I think that having all your eggs in the D2C basket is really risky, right? And channel diversification, not only transactional channel diversification, but marketing channel diversification is massively important when you're a pure play e-commerce brand as you are. I think even if you were an omnichannel brand, meaning you had your own D2C physical retail stores, I think you would still want to start further enhancing the split. I think in a perfect world, we would want to be targeting like a 50-50 split, 50% D2C, 50% wholesale. That is like the definition of de-risking your business model. And so I think that's really smart for you to focus on this, particularly overseas expansion from a wholesale perspective. I think one of the things you have to think about, there's probably two big things to think about, is one, how can we validate the market quickly, cheaply, and easily? Meaning, is there a way that we could, for example, sell on Amazon Business as a wholesaler through Amazon Business in the United States to test the waters? And could we do that via FBA, where we don't now have to think about shipping cartons, pallets, and containers to individual distributors or retail chains in the United States and manage all that logistics and have it be super capital intensive? Can we prove out the market through a B2B marketplace? And I suspect that there is probably an equine, I don't know because I don't play in your vertical, but I suspect that there are one or more equine specific marketplaces. And I suspect there may even be equine B2B marketplaces in the United States that you may want to forge a relationship with to test the waters on. So I think before you start saying, okay, let's reach out to 2-3 regional distributors in the United States of equine products and see if they want to take our products on. And then what does that look like? Do they expect us to cover flooring costs for a period of 20? What kind of trade terms do they expect from us? What kind of inventory holding capability do they expect us to have? Do they expect us to transship under bond into the United States? How do they? There's a lot to consider when we're talking about, it's a very different thing to do cross-border direct-to-consumer e-commerce from Australia, shipping door-to-door from via Australia Post, for example, to you, and then attaching to USPS in the United States and getting it to someone's door. A pair of leggings door-to-door, there's a lot less logistical hassles that go along with that versus shipping cartons, pallets, and containers, as you already know from the small amount of wholesale business you do in Australia today. So it's a totally different kettle of fish. And I suspect that some of those distributors, the trading terms that they will expect you to accept for them to distribute your products, they may be fairly capital intensive. This is my concern. So I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, even if you reach out to them and at least ask the question and say, what are your criteria that you look at for suppliers, to new suppliers to take on as a distributor? What are the things that you look for? What are the trading terms that you normally like to have with your suppliers, right? And I always say that what you want to be in a position to be able to tell them is you can dictate the price or the terms, but you can't dictate both.
I like that.
So you pick. You either dictate the pricing and the margins, or you dictate the terms. I need to have some wiggle room. I need to have some leverage from my side to be able to make this work and build a sustainable business off the back of this. So that's how I would open that dialogue. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to at least open the dialogue with a couple of local distributors in the United States. And you may want to have a West Coast distributor, an East Coast distributor, and maybe a Midwest distributor, possibly, because where one is strong, one may be weak, et cetera. And you want to also, if they're doing local warehousing, then obviously it's much cheaper to ship from, you don't want to necessarily have to ship from LA to New York, right? That's going to escalate the costs for them. So ideally, they would have local inventory holding capabilities, et cetera, that they would extend to you. So I think opening at least a dialogue with them is probably even before you seriously consider selling through them, opening a dialogue with them and just asking them what their criteria is for taking on new products. I think that's a great question to ask so that you can start getting your ducks in a row. But then I think in parallel to that, you're probably going to want to look at marketplace options to validate, I guess, market relevance. Now, again, I'm not an expert in your space. I don't know, for example, if equestrian horsey people in Australia like different things than horsey people in the States. I have no idea. Maybe they like exactly the same things, or maybe they will like your horsey stuff from Australia even better because it's not American, because it's Australian and people like that foreign stuff. I know that, for example, lots of clean green products come from New Zealand, for example, and they're massively popular in the United States, especially a lot of natural skincare products, hair care products, et cetera. Massive market for New Zealand-based natural healthcare and natural food products, actually, in the United States. And so there is this novelty value when it comes from a different place. But I just don't know. And I think you could, at relatively low risk, you could probably move a small amount of inventory into FBA and test it through Amazon Business to try to grow the wholesale business. But you could potentially also be looking at, effectively at the same time, you then are potentially testing the market in the United States for selling through Amazon, D2C through Amazon. So I think there's a few ways you could slice and dice this, but I would be looking at marketplace-based validation first, in parallel having dialogues with potential distributors, seeing what it would look like to supply to them and whether they have any appetite for it, or what you may have to change about your products or pricing or range or whatever to be able to get in with them. And then obviously there's a big difference between supplying local distributor and a retail chain. So I'm guessing that there are also probably very large retail chains in the United States. And I'm thinking even like Boot Barn, I think, in the United States carries equine products, for example. So I wouldn't just be looking at equestrian retail chains. I would be looking at market adjacent retail chains. So for example, I don't know if Dick's Sporting Goods carries equestrian products. Maybe they do. Maybe they've got a small equestrian section, but they are massive and they're right across the whole of the United States. So I would potentially be looking at sporting goods chains that have equestrian products, or some of those chains may not have them like in stock, in store at all times, but maybe they would offer them as a web only item to sell online only, because they could carry them in like their local DC, their local distribution center, but they may not want to put them in their stores, but they may want to carry them online and offer them online. So I think that we want to look at all of our wholesale options. And the one thing I would caution against, some of these distributors may say, we will only take you on if we have exclusivity. I would say that nowadays that used to be the norm, and it was this incestuous relationship between manufacturers and distributors where everybody was protecting each other's back in the market. It's not really that way anymore. And you want competition between your distributors. You want them to add value beyond just carrying your product in their warehouse and making it available in the market. And also you want to keep a cap on the wholesale price of your product so that it's really attractive when it gets into retailers' hands. But I think you also want to be reasonably transparent, and you're holding all the cards as the brand owner. You're holding all the cards here, meaning that you want to be really, maybe you don't tell them up front, but if a distributor starts playing hardball with you, you can be pretty transparent with them and say, look, we are in discussions with a number of distributors, not just you. And we're also in discussions with a number of very large scale retailers as well. One of the value adds that they might be able to bring to the table is if, let's say hypothetically, they are already distributing products to Dick's Sporting Goods, and they say, don't bother going and having a conversation with Dick's Sporting Goods because that's going to be a really hard conversation to have, and they really don't normally buy direct through manufacturers. They normally buy through local distributors, but we've already gotten in there, and we can just add you to our catalog, and they'll just take it on straight away. That's where I think certain distributors have a leg up, and that's what you want to look at. You want to say, okay, what are the routes to market that you already have that I don't need to go and secure? And that is a value add. It really depends on how many relationships, retail relationships, for example, they've already got in their portfolio of goods. What are the relationships they've already got that you don't have? Because you can spend a lot of time chasing up all these rats and mice retailers, but you might be able to cover 70% of them with a single distributor, potentially. So these are the types of, I think, things that you want to have in the back of your mind when you're having these discussions with them, is what are they bringing to the table for me other than just a warehouse to ship my goods out of? Because remember, you could work with a 3PL on the West Coast, the East Coast, and Midwest, and you could supply directly to all those resellers in the United States yourself. Now, there's certain cost structures and complications that go along with that, but you could do that. And so you don't necessarily have to have a distributor in the United States, but if they bring significant value to the table, you may want one. So these are the types of questions I'd be asking myself. Does that all make sense?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Love it.
I really like those ideas as well, especially around the sporting goods and the affinity sort of thinking of not just the horse industry, but something outside of that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're going to want to listen to, I've got an episode of the podcast coming out tomorrow that is going to be totally relevant to you. It is a company called Locally, L-O-C-A-L-Y, in the United States. They are bridging the digital gap on behalf of brand owners like you. What they are doing is they are getting feeds from all of the major retailers in the United States of their products for their physical stores, so that if someone wants to go and find, literally walk into a store and buy your goods today, they are providing a marketplace and search engine for where the physical stores are carrying these products. So you can go in and you can search for a product, and you will instantly see across the whole United States where you can literally walk in a store today and get that product. And so they basically are acting as an aggregator of all the physical locations where your products are available. And they're aggregating that on behalf of manufacturing brands like you. So that way you can also list that on your website as well, so that once you have retailers on board, instead of just having a dealer locator or a store locator on your website that says, oh, if you're in California, these are the 5 stores or these are the 100 stores that carry our goods. No. These are the stores that actually have them in stock right now. So this goes one step beyond this whole store locator idea to, no, here's the product locator. And this is how much they have of each at each location of each SKU. So this is where we're now starting to bridge the gap between physical and digital. Now, by working with Locally, you are helping to drive foot traffic to their, and this is the benefit, this is the value add that you have. You say, look, we're working with Locally. So I would suggest that basically the moment that you sign your first big retailer or your first big distributor, and then you know that it's in physical stores, I would sign up with Locally that day. And I would say, I'm working hard to drive foot traffic for you into your physical stores. By my manufacturer's website, my branded website, I want it to drive traffic for you, and vice versa. You're obviously driving sales for me. So by having my product in your store, if they come in and maybe you don't have the size, or maybe they can wait, they don't need it that day or whatever, then maybe they come to your direct consumer website and buy it directly through you, or you may eventually have a direct consumer website for the American market. You might have a multi-site environment with Shopify to where you've got a local, or you're working with Shopify Markets, for example. Yeah. There's lots of opportunities for you here, but I think it all starts with really good strategic wholesale relationships.
Yeah, I love that. Going on to that as well, like how you can push people into the store. Do you have any recommendations, I suppose, around running ads? Like sometimes they'll run like an email campaign based on people's postcode and proximity to where where we're stocked in stores. Do you think there's any other sort of like little things that we could be doing or even just trialing with our current retail in Australia before we push more for the US? That's sort of in that realm of digital advertising or any sort of marketing you think could give us a different advantage point compared to everyone else who probably isn't doing anything.
Geofencing and geotargeting is totally possible in every single one of the major ad platforms. If you wanted to drive foot traffic, then you obviously know who you could be advertising, literally running ads on that links. When they click on that, it actually takes them to your retailer's website. So you could even potentially work out a bit of a co-spend with those retailers and say, look, okay, we're going to split the cost of this. We're going to run the campaigns because we've got all the collateral, we've got all the creative, we got all that stuff. So we're going to drive the ads and we're going to manage and maintain those ads, but we're going to ring fence and geofence these ads and these ad sets to drive traffic to your website and your physical stores. So let's split the costs of that and let's reassess the benefits of this over 1, 2, 3 months, whatever it is. Maybe we do a trial for 3 months. We split the cost. We pay up front and then we bill you after the fact, or we add it maybe to your invoice. We work some sort of a way. Or what we say is, we say, if you want to run ads specifically for our products and you can show that those campaigns are running specifically for our products, we will give you a 50% advertising credit on your bill with us or something like that. There's multiple ways to slice and dice this, but I think definitely doing collabs with your retail partners is a massive opportunity.
Yeah, I love that. I even just love like a whitelist Facebook ad where it's like the retail name and Equipad.
100%. 100%. Anything that associates that retail brand with your brand is going to be beneficial to them. It's going to be beneficial to both of you, actually. Especially if they're a well-known retail brand. And then all of a sudden they become a halo brand over your products, then that, because it's almost like an endorsement. It's we carry the product, so they've obviously got to be good.
Yeah, perfect. I think that's such an interesting space. And I feel like no one is capitalizing. Like you said, like everyone is so D2C focused. But as soon as we started going B2B, it just changed our entire business. So now it's like, how can we capitalize on this even more and stand out from the rest that has taken the old school approach?
As somebody, you're speaking my language now, because I tell you, I work so heavily in the B2B space now that I'm trying to help these B2B brands figure out that this whole digital thing, it's got legs. It's not going away. This whole digital thing is not going away. So eventually you'll also have to, and I don't want to belabor the point here, but once you have established routes to market, wholesale routes to market, you're probably going to want to set up a new dedicated B2B e-commerce storefront. Because you're already on Shopify Plus, aren't you? You're already on Plus?
I'm not on Plus. I'm just on Shopify.
So you'll either probably want to go with a different platform for B2B e-commerce, because the biggest buyers, okay, I'll tell you right now that the very largest of buyers in the United States, they will not want to do e-commerce and they will not want to do manual PO, emailing, carrier pigeon, the fax. They're going to want to do EDI. Electronic data interchange. They're going to want to have an EDI connection into your systems, your back office systems, to where their ERP generates a PO. It automatically sends it across via EDI, which generates the sales order dynamically in your back office system. Just it starts out as a PO in their system, ends up as an SO in your system, and boom, it's an order that's lodged and then it's ready to ship, right? But your mid-market B2B customers are going to probably want either PunchOut, which is an e-procurement connection between their procurement system and your backend, or self-service e-commerce, right? Yep. And you'll probably want, and you're going to have to think very strategically about whether you have a price list per B2B customer, whether you have tiered pricing, standardized trade pricing, whether you have MOQs, whether you have buying increments. There's lots to think about when you're going wholesale. Like I'm talking large scale wholesale. And the decisions that you make today will have very long-term impacts in terms of operations and technology. So we want to start thinking about that stuff now so that it doesn't, quote unquote, grow organically, which means without a plan. And this is what I oftentimes see when I go into these B2B businesses. They've grown their B2B business and it's like a 50-headed Hydra by the time I get there because they didn't grow intentionally. They just did whatever the market wanted at the time. And now they've got 1,000 price lists in their business, for example. And now they have different MOQ requirements by customer. They've got different buying increment requirements by customer. They've got all these different complexities in their business simply because they didn't have a plan when they started out and they just were trying to win deals. And whatever they had to do to win the deal, they won the deal. And then that stuck, that process with that customer stuck. And now trying to unpick that rat's nest is a real challenge. So we want to start thinking very holistically about our wholesale business now before we get to 50% of our revenues being wholesale. We want to grow with intention.
Yeah. Now, when you say the B2B platform, like I know Shopify Plus has a B2B part of it, other platforms, is there any other recommendations that you can maybe when you're starting out, you obviously don't maybe want to go to Shopify Plus yet, like that sort of intermediate platform, is there any recommendations on that?
There's not so much intermediate platforms, but there are plugins or apps. So for example, Shopify and BigCommerce have B2B apps and SparkLayer is probably one of the best in the market.
Yeah.
There's Wholesale Grill and a few others. When you're on a lower tier of plan below Plus, and when you're on a lower tier plan in the BigCommerce world, for example, they've got B2B Edition, which is the highest tier of enterprise, and it's got all the B2B functionality built in. And in fact, it's got a lot more B2B functionality than B2B on Shopify does. Shopify's catching up fast, but they are way behind. They were very late to the B2B game. They've really only been working on this for 12 to 18 months on like hard out.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, I'm hearing stories they've spent about $650 million on B2B in the last 18 months. Mm-hmm. So they know that's the future of e-commerce. That's where their next big growth phase is going to come from is B2B. And so they know they've got to, they're playing catch up. I love BigCommerce. Again, you're looking at around roughly $2,500 a month starting for B2B edition. Yeah. It's always negotiated on a per customer perspective, but that's like ballpark. And it's this, and it's obviously the same with Plus is ballpark $2,500 a month USD. So they're in the same price bracket. So my suggestion would be is to set up a new Shopify storefront. It can just be, it doesn't have to be Plus. It could just be Shopify and then start off with an app like a SparkLayer, which adds all that B2B functionality over the top of core Shopify. And then once you get to maybe, I don't know, a couple of million, two, 3 million a year in wholesale sales, then we can start really looking at some proper B2B technology. Yeah. And you'll probably need to upgrade your back end and get a PIM and an ERP and some other stuff because QuickBooks and other things won't cut it when you get to $1, $2, $3, $4 million, you're starting to get into some complex operations, complex financials, complex reporting. There's just lots more stuff that happens. And especially when you're currently doing your own logistics, by that point, you will probably want to be taking on 3PLs. As well, as opposed to doing your own warehousing and pick, pack, dispatch. Because if you stay with your own warehouse, you'll then need a WMS. You'll then not be able to just organize your warehouse manually anymore by like product or product category on the shelves. It'll need to be, you'll need things like chaotic put away and all sorts of things that you can't do manually in your head anymore. Yeah, we'll certainly think about that. Once you get to that level, then you'll have the money to do the right things at the right time.
Yeah.
But for now, what we're trying to do is we're trying to validate market relevance, trying to validate market size or TAM, total addressable market. And we're trying to identify the best wholesale routes to market in the new regions you're looking at. So we got to do those steps first before we worry about anything else.
Incredible as always. Thank you.
Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you. And now back to your listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Mentoring Moments. I'm here with my mate, Alex, and we're just talking through some of the options when these guys are looking at doing some potential outbound prospecting for their platform or their app for Shopify merchants that allows pre-purchasing of products. What we were talking about was, how do we do this? How do we go out there and put ourselves on a merchant's radar so that they first know we exist? Second of all, understand our market and make sure that we're building things that are super relevant to our target customers or merchants in this case. And how do we do it in such a way that we don't come across as salesy, we don't come across as offensive, we don't come across as spammy? It's a fine line, right? It's how do we put ourselves on these merchants' radar en masse so that we have the opportunity to potentially win some more business. But again, we want to be a magnet. This is my saying for myself. I want to be a magnet, not a lasso. And outbound is always comes across as trying to rope people in that haven't necessarily shown any intent whatsoever to buy or even any interest in your product. Unless you're tracking people that visit your website but don't sign up for information, for example, and then you use something like retention.com to unmask who those are and identify them, and totally, then they've shown some form of intent at least when they come to your website. And then maybe that forms a warm, as opposed to a completely cold outbound list, at least that forms a warm outbound list because they've shown some form of intent by coming to your website. And then also off the back of that, you can create lookalike audiences off the back of that list that then forms a slightly less warm outbound prospecting list of emails. But I think your question really came down to, what is the type of content? How can we craft an email that doesn't come across as spammy or salesy, but gets us into a chance to have a dialogue with these potential merchants? And I'll let you recontextualize this in your own words.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we're looking at doing some sort of automated prospecting and outbounds. The tools out there are great. They help you keep up to date with who you're messaging and when you're going to re-message them. But the one thing they don't do is, and the one thing they all recommend to do is just be really open and blunt with the sell. And like all these guides online, tell them what you do in one line, show them the benefits, and then, you know, what's the follow-up? Do you want to jump on a call? And we were testing this internally, and we were, you know, testing the emails with each of our own LinkedIn profiles and email accounts. And it came across as, if I was getting this, I wouldn't respond because I know this dude is just after a sale. I know exactly what he wants. He doesn't really care about me and he just wants revenue. So what I was asking you, Jason, was how we can make these emails or the copy and the content, like you said, inside of these outbound messages, less salesy, but eventually get us into a place where we position ourselves to get on a call with a potential prospect or start a dialogue, like you said. And from the sounds of it, I think the way to go is, and it's actually how I operate more naturally, is just to be open and kind and honest and say, look, we're a startup, we're building this. You are like our ideal customer. To have you as a customer will be amazing. Rub their egos a little bit and just be open and honest and say, but we need your help, or we want your help, or we want your insights. What I found traditionally that asking people for help is actually the easiest way to get on a call with them, as opposed to doing the hard sell, like you said. I think that's something that we'll start to look into a little bit more and tweak our messaging to be more open and honest and a feedback and a sort of collaborative approach, as opposed to, hey, here's our awesome product. It's amazing. Other brands love it. You should use it, which I don't think would work as well.
Yeah, I think what my key thinking was here is to, as you said, basically say, look, you are our prototypical perfect target client. If we were selling into the market, you are the type of client we'd love to work with. However, we also want to make sure that our product is as relevant, is as current, is as targeted as it can be, that it is actually delivering serious value for our customers. So can you answer these three questions? You know, what, for example, one question might be, what would we have to add to our platform to make it an absolute no-brainer for you to say yes to? What kind of pricing model would make sense to you? Is it a tiered pricing model? Is it a rev share pricing model? What, just three, I would say no more than three questions. And then I would also make an offer at the end and say, hey, we'd love to get you for free, no cost to you, into our beta program, because we're still in early beta. We're still developing our product. It's still new. It hasn't been finalized yet, but we'd like to get you for free for a 6-month, 3-month, 1-month 30-day, 60-day, 90-day, whatever it is, beta program so that you can see whether this platform actually is beneficial to you and then give us feedback. All we ask for no payment. The only thing we ask for is at the end, if you would give us your honest feedback about how the platform worked for you. And we'll also be providing analytics and some performance data around what we think it did. But we would love some feedback from you, whether it be anecdotally from your customers or people who tried it, through customer service, whatever it is. We would love your feedback on whether this platform has actually helped your business grow or not. The answer no is equally good, because we want to know whether our platform is actually doing what we set out to make it do. And so I think emailing is just hard, no matter how you contextualize it, no matter what you say, no matter how you say it, it's just hard. But I think going in for the kill, which is what all these hardcore sales guys will tell you to do, because usually they're trying to sell you the platform that does mass outbound prospecting. It's those guys selling those platforms that are telling you to go for the throat, because they want you to continue to use your platform to go after a larger and larger cohort of colder and colder potential prospects. That's what they want you to do, because you usually pay based on volume, right? Yeah. And so but like you say, having empathy for the person receiving the bloody email, because I receive cold outbound emails every single day. As a consultant, you can imagine how much cold outbound I receive from new platform vendors and people that want me to become partners. And it's slightly overwhelming at times. And I very rarely respond to those cold emails. Usually I delete and block those email addresses, but the ones I respond to are the ones who are not trying to sell me. That's all I can say. And so I think if you go in with a heart of humility, a heart of gratitude for their time, asking them maximum of 3 questions, inviting them to a free beta program to help you improve your product, as that's the value exchange that takes place. We'll give you free access to our product. We just want valid and clear feedback on how we can improve this product and make it more market relevant so that we can find product market fit, because we're still in the product market fit stage. You can even say that. Look, we're still trying to find that perfect product market fit. We know we haven't found it yet, and we need your help to get there. And we'll let you be part of our beta program to help us get there. Be one of our design partners for this initial beta phase. We're intending to hopefully close this phase down with sometime within the next 3 to 6 months, but it really depends on how many design partners we can get on board quickly to help iterate and improve our product quickly so that we're ready with that perfect product market fit to go to market with. Yeah, all I can say is the more humble, the better. Don't go for the throat, regardless of what these sales gurus will tell you. I'm sure you have been on the receiving end of plenty of cold outbound emails. And just think of that. Think of how cold outbound emails make you feel. And always keep in mind the potential long-term brand damage of a bad outbound email campaign. Just think that can scuttle your brand indefinitely if you become as the spammy outbound mail people. That will become a sort of a black mark on your record that is really hard to recover from. And that would be my only advice, is to just be really overly cautious. And for that matter, you can get your domain blacklisted if enough people report you for spam. So it's a risky proposition, which is why so many of these cold outbound people, they set up bulk Gmail accounts for sending these spammy outbound emails because they don't want their root domain damaged. So just be careful. I send all emails personally. I very rarely do any form of cold outbound. But if I do, it's all sent from my personal email address at my domain. So that causes me to be extra careful with any kind of outreach that I do, because I want that always to be in the back of my mind, that I'm not trying to make this a scalable mass market spam attempt. That's not what I'm trying to do. I've only probably sent a grand total of 5 outbound prospecting emails in my life, but they always took me 15 to 30 minutes worth of research on the prospect before I sent the email, because I really wanted to tailor it to their potential problem that I thought I could solve for. So I'm just not a big fan of mass outbound, but when you do it, I think you just got to do it with humility.
Okay. That's super useful. Thank you, Jason.
If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.